So I'm here with Philip Says, and Philip, I've got to say, actually, why is it taking you so long to get back here? I mean, come on,
yeah,
really. I mean, we're literally almost in your home where you were born.
I know, we were just talking about this. You're saying it's just over an hour away.
Literally, you're the wrong side of the river, but it's about an hour and 10, hour and 15.
By car, just said,
Well,
maybe we should go drive after the show, well, go check it out.
I think take the guitar, we'll get a bottle of Jack. I mean, I'm with you.
I'll drive. I'm more than happy to let you have the Jack, and I'll drive, and you tell me where we're going.
So, 2 years you spent in Aberystwyth. Of course, you moved over to Canada.
That's right.
We've come a long way, haven't we, from you dancing around your house with a tennis racket to Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's been an incredible journey you've become. And everything that you play is self-taught.
Well, everything that I'm playing and working on, I'm a student of music for life, so... everything is self-taught just by watching people that I admire.
But it must be you must have a hell of a gift for being a teacher, because I've been watching you with the warm-up outside, and it evokes memories of every influence you've ever had. I mean, from Hendrix right the way through to Eric Clapton. I mean, there's bits of everything, and you just play it as if it's an extension of you.
Oh, that's so kind. Well, thank you. I mean, these are the players you just mentioned, and many others are a lot of players that are sort of the soundtrack of my life. My parents played in the house while I was growing up, and certainly, you know, my dad would, the first time we heard the song Crossfire by Stevie Ray Vaughan, and my dad, you know, was in the car with my dad, and he leaned over and he goes, man, this guy's as good as Eric Clapton. And Clapton, you know, in the house was the top. So when he was like, man, Stevie's as good as Eric? Wow. I was a little kid. I didn't understand. Music is never a competition. But no, these players were played in the house all the time. And Ry Cooder and B.B. King, Buddy Guy, Albert Collins. You know, really a lot of great music. And so I'm thankful to my mom and dad for sharing that.
Your first gig was Eric Clapton at the Toronto the Maple Leaf Gardens.
I love that you know that it was called Maple Leaf Gardens. Very good.
I mean, really famous venue. So, but not only was Clapton playing there, but also one of your other major influences, Mark Knopfler, was playing there.
Yeah.
On the same stage.
Yeah, it was a 2-for-1 Guitar Hero situation. Yeah, and I mean, I was a kid. I wasn't playing guitar at the time. I didn't really understand. But I knew that something happened to my body when Clapton walked out and started playing. That show, he was starting, they were playing that kind of Crossroads version, but not the up-tempo one, but the kind of more groovy one.
Yeah.
And he, you know, the lights went down, everyone went crazy, and you could hear him sort of playing this stuff. And I remember as a kid, I could have fainted, you know, and then the lights come up and here he is, and he was dressed in the suit and, you know, all of that, and just played his ass off. And then Mark Knopfler was there. And when I was, you know, when I was really little, I used to also bounce around playing, you know, the Brothers in Arms album.
Yeah.
Money for Nothing was a big hit for me when I was little. And so there he was, you know, so it was really a life-changing experience for me.
As you know, and as we all know, that having the talent, which you obviously have, is not enough to succeed in this business. And you need to have a little bit of luck, a little bit of good fortune, timing, being in the right place at the right time. And you've had that, because if you look back to two occasions in your life, one when you'd met Jeff Healey on a number of occasions, the third time you end up jamming on stage, and that's when you're in the back of the manager's car on the way back, and he's going, well, do you want to come and join us? I mean, this was a good day for you.
Oh, I remember it well. I remember the car. I remember the texture of the seats in the car. And I remember, my dear friend to this day, Corey Miluk from Toronto. Corey was very close with Jeff and used to take care of Jeff, really take him to different clubs. And when Jeff was a teenager and, you know, on the scene, and they became friends, and so... I was a teenager, and Corey and I met. We bonded over wah-wah pedals, and he knew, obviously, Jeff was one of my main influences, and loved him very much. And so he said, hey, Jeff, there's a guy. He's coming up, and he really likes you, and I think you should. I didn't know he was doing this. And so, Jeff showed up at a show, and and I didn't know until after, and people were like, Jeff was here. I was like, oh shit, what? What?
This was why the crowd was going.
That's, yeah, people started making, I was like, wow, everyone's really into it tonight. And then they said, well, my friends were backing me up. And then, yeah, and then Jeff, we jammed one of these nights, and he played the bass, and I think he wanted to kind of see what was going on, and he scared the shit out of me. And then, yeah, then we went out, and he said, hey man, why don't you join my band, and we'll teach you how to do it, and then we'll get you ready, and we'll get you out on your own. I mean, he was, apart from being just about, there's nobody better than Jeff. I mean, when he was playing, it was like, oh, like really master ninja playing, master, just otherworldly musician. And, but he was a man of his word, and he really backed me up and gave me a chance.
There was one great piece of advice that he gave you, wasn't there? Because I can imagine, there you are, you're very young, you've got all this enthusiasm, all this energy, you want to get out there, you want to give it everything.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like 150 miles an hour, and he just pulls you over and says, look, slow down, smell the roses.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I love that.
Well, because here's the thing, Jeff could play faster than the speed of light, and he could play slower than molasses. Like, he was just, he had it all, you know, and I was so in awe of him. And I think he was coaching me, you know, he was a coach. And so he kind of, every night on stage, you know, he would give me a lot of time to play. And then he would be like, okay, good. And then he would play and be like, oh man. And then, so he was really stretching me like a rubber band, like Gumby, because he's like, man, this guy loves it. And so he really opened my heart, and he poured in some love.
But if you thought that was good, so you're there, you've blown up a few amps, and you're in LA, and was it Westwood Music, wasn't it?
Or, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Westwood Music in LA.
Yeah.
And you're in there on an ordinary day, and you plug your guitar in, and then some guy comes up to you and says, who the hell are you? where do you come from? What's your name? Who do you play for? What are you?
Yeah.
Here's my card.
Yeah.
And this is the A&R guy from Atlantic Records.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know is you're working with Melissa.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, this gentleman is one of the most successful producers of all time. Tremendous guitar hero amazing musician and composer, John Shanks is his name. And I think he's got over 60 million records sold to his credit as a producer. And I think he's part of Bon Jovi's band now. But he's also been somebody that was a real godsend. And I feel like I learned a lot from him. And he gave me a chance. You know, I was new in town at the time. Yeah, I went to Westwood trying amps. Because on the road, I'd been blowing amps up. I was playing with an artist named Uncle Cracker time. And he was really, had a huge hit at the time, and it was a great, amazing learning experience. And so John just said, yeah, come to my studio. And he really liked this guitar that I had. The guitar, her name is Mother. And
Mother's not with us.
Mother's at home.
But you got Big Daddy.
Big Daddy's here. Mother's at home having a smoking a pancake or something, as I was saying before. She's just chilling, watching Netflix. But John invited me to his studio. At the time, he was over at Henson in LA, and I went by, and he had all these beautiful old guitars and Dumble amps, and we just kind of hit it off. And so he gave Melissa Etheridge a call.
Yeah.
She was looking for someone that could play and sing, and then when Melissa and I met, we really hit it off as well. She was amazing, and her band, I mean, it was Kenny Aronoff on drums, I mean, come on, and Mark Brown on bass. I mean, these guys were big cats. And so I was a little terrified, but I went in, and they were really nice to me.
And they said that you were given room to express your own talent. You weren't just there as, right, do this, when you've done that, stay there. You know, you were given a chance to solo, you were given a chance to come out on the stage and wow the crowd.
Well, I mean, it was really Melissa. I mean, it's all Melissa, right? And she's such a powerful artist. And she just said, hey, you know, I'm going to give you, I want you to play. And, you know, when you're done, give me a wink and we'll get back to it. So she was so generous and such an amazing mentor and one of the most powerful artists I've ever seen or had the pleasure of collaborating with. And
So why'd you leave? I mean, I know why we left. I mean, it's to develop your own career, your own personality. And, you know, it was a big move. But when you look at the success that you'd had, and it had come, I mean, there'd obviously been work behind it, but it seemed that, you know, you had a knack for being in the right place at the right time. So transferring this into a solo career would be a piece of cake.
Well, it's not really, but
no,
I think.
So was it a surprise to you that, you know, it was more graft and, you know, more work than you thought?
I think both are true. So I had already been, I'd signed with a record company when I was 19, just before I'd signed up with Jeff. I'd signed with a record company and sort of done some recordings, which were released on a release that's, I think it's called Philip Sace Group, and some of them were finished, some of them were, you know, could have used a little bit more grease on them, but they're fine. I love them. They're very raw and honest, and so I'd already been doing stuff, and then in between tours, I was doing my own shows as well with Melissa and Jeff, and Melissa always knew that I was doing my own thing, and so just like with Jeff, it came to a place where it was like, you know, I think it's time, you know, you gotta go do your thing too, and that's the sign of a real musical friend, somebody that, so she really gave
as
me a great
best
push.
Interest in
the heart. Oh, yeah, yeah.
The one quote I did love that I saw of yours when somebody was saying to you, so, you know, what is the main difference here? And you said, well, you know, here we are, we've gone from the Ritz and the Mandarin Oriental and the Four Seasons to the Travelodge on Marylebone Road.
Yeah, if you're lucky. Yeah, where they're burning mattresses in the parking lot. I mean, seriously, it was
character building. There,
oh
too.
Man, yeah, yeah, and you know, like going from traveling in a very very cushy posh way. You know, like you're flying. Sometimes we'd be flying private. You know, you just roll into this beautiful venue. I mean, with Melissa, she has a lot of high end celebrity friends, and so. You know, we got to play around, you know.
You looking up at the audience, oh shit, that's Clint Eastwood.
Oh yeah, no, it's crazy. That's, you know, just friends with Pete, you know, all of the Steven Spielberg and all this. It was amazing. And, you know, just a great learning experience and watching how she carried herself. And so she was a real influence to me both on and off stage, you know. She's a great person.
So, big couple of months coming up for you because you've got the new album, The Wolves Are Coming. So, what's behind the title, first of all? where were you, on what state of mind were you in when you dreamt up the title?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So really, most of the album was, you know, sort of conceived and written during the pandemic, this lockdown era, and not really knowing if there was going to be any opportunity. And so I just really locked myself up for a couple of years, just practicing every day for as many hours as I could before my... you know, before driving my wife crazy or whatever, but just, you know, playing as long as I could and singing. I would go out to the car and sing for an hour a day in the car and just made the most of it, used it as a training time, and then also carved out a certain number each of hours each day to write new music.
Yeah.
And so it became a real focused work period for me, not knowing what was going to happen. And the Wolves Are Coming is really, it has so many different meanings for me, but the one that's coming to mind right now is it's sort of like a kick in the ass, like the wolves are coming, get going, like we got
a message to yourself,
message to myself, time to get moving, and so, you know, don't dawdle here, let's get moving.
We've got a range of styles here. We've already seen the Witch's Brew. I need a Freudian slip there. And Lady Love Divine, which now this was a really surprising track, because putting this on first time and listening to this, all of a sudden, because you're a great lover of funk.
Oh,
You love funk, you love groove.
For sure.
And this has elements of Stevie Wonder. There was elements of Walshy and the James Gang.
Oh, wow.
In there. It had a really groovy feel. So is that where we're going with this album? Or is it just you've throwing a whole lot of stuff in there, and this just happens to be one that's different?
Well, if those names come up by listening to that song, it's the biggest, that's the biggest compliment you could imagine, and to me, so thank you. And I think really there's a number of different lanes on the album.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is a song that I've had for a while. I had started the song some time ago in a writing session with Richard Marx. Right. And we had written a lot of songs together, and this was one that during the pandemic I found. I was like, oh, that could be good. And so I finished the song, and it came out the way it did, and I'm happy with it.
Great track. Really, really good track.
Thank you.
Because you know you put on something, and you almost know what you're going to be hearing before it arrives. Yeah, and this is why having the element of surprise is a big thing, and that was a big surprise.
Oh, well, that's great to hear. And you know, I'm always trying to push myself and try to keep learning and growing. I mean, as I said, I'm a student of music. So, and you mentioned Stevie Wonder. I'm a huge fan of Stevie Wonder. His catalog is impossible to describe the brilliance of the man. And so there is a little Stevie influence along with other people in there. And but I think just trying to do the best that I can with this song, and it's ultimately a love song, and just want to have fun with it.
And so you're doing a short tour over here in the UK.
That's right.
Are there plans to get back and do a big one, festival appearances maybe next summer?
I sure hope so. If they'll have us, if you're listening, we welcome the opportunity.
Felix says thank you very, very much.
It's been
a pleasure.
Thank you.
And good luck with the album.
All right.
We're looking forward to seeing the show tonight.
Oh, man. Thank you for this opportunity. And we'll see you tonight. Let's have some fun.
Yeah, we're doing.
All right. Cheers.
And we aren't really going to get in a car with a bottle of Jack Daniels.
No, I don't drink. So.
Do you not drink?
I don't drink. No.
Shit. What? Never?
Once a year I'll have an Aperol spritz or something, but no, I don't enjoy it.
That's how the complexion stays.
I don't know about that, but I don't really.
There is much in the way of lineage.
I have no, you know, if you want to drink, like I said, I'll drive. You do the drinking, I'll do the driving.
You do the playing.
Well,
take care, my friend.
Cheers, my friend. Thank you.
Talking a minute ago about this place up the road where my mom spit me out and Aberystwyth, and we left and we moved to Canada when I was like really little, so I don't remember much about it, but it's right there on my passport, and I was trying to figure out how to spell the word Aberystwyth. It's a little tricky. but so this is a song that I recorded a while back. The song is called Aberystwyth. We're gonna get it going, a little Muddy Waters up top. Thank you.
So we are here in the back annals of the Fleece in Bristol with Jared James Nichols.
Here I am. Thank you for coming here.
Well, it's a pleasure. But the story, your story.
Yeah.
20 years. It's been only 20 years since your mum bundled you in the back of that family truckster.
That's true.
On a Sunday afternoon, mm-hmm. and drove you to that gig, that Sunday afternoon jam,
yep.
in that little club outside of Chicago.
Yep.
And you're even on stage on day one.
Yeah, that's something that my parents, they didn't grow up, I didn't grow up with any musicians or, you know, kind of music scene around, but my mom was so smart. When I started to play the guitar and I found the blues, she said, there's a blues jam and they do barbecue and blues. And I was like, yeah, let's go. And I said, I'm not going to bring my guitar. And she's like, well, you should. Maybe you could get up and jam. And I was so nervous. No way. And I'll never forget that moment where she went up to the bartender and said, my son is an excellent guitar player. He didn't bring his guitar, but if you guys have a guitar here, he'd love to try it. And I remember I was just like, I was so nervous. I was so nervous. I went into the bathroom before. And I remember there was a guy there. He was an old harmonica player. And he said, you all right? And I was like, yeah, I'm just a little kid. I'm washing my hands. And he goes, just remember, playing music, it's kind of like swimming. Either you're going to figure it out quick or you're going to drown. And I was like, okay. So I go on stage. I have the cable. I'm so nervous. I can't even get it in the guitar. And I start to play. And from that moment on, that was it. That's what I wanted to do.
So you get home. Because your first guitar was an acoustic, so
yep.
you get an electric guitar, and all of the musical influences, all of them, the musical styles and trends that are dragging you here, left, right, and everywhere else, your first riff that you played
yep.
was Electric Communion.
Oh, Electric Funeral.
Electric Funeral.
Yep. Close enough, though. Yep. Yes, it was, because I remember I only had a few CDs at the time, and I had this Black Sabbath CD, and I grew up, before the guitar, I really loved all the English stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a kid listening to The Stones, The Who, Mott the Hoople, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, The Kinks. I mean, it was Cream.
But were you listening to this on your own? Because I'm looking at the era that you're born in.
Oh, yeah.
You're 34.
Yep.
So, you know, we're talking about the 1990s and the noughties. I mean, what were your friends listening to? Because there's always a lot of peer pressure, isn't there?
Absolutely.
With music and kids.
So. My friends, they were not listening to this. They were listening to, like, you know, Kid Rock and Korn and all that stuff. But my dad, when we would drive around, classic rock.
Yeah.
So I heard Queen and I heard, like, I remember hearing, like, Another Brick in the Wall Part 2, and I was like, wow, this is so cool. And it's funny because before I even wanted to play the guitar, I was already like in love with the music. And I remember I had this Black Sabbath CD and I was going through the tracks on it thinking to myself, which one sounds the easiest? And I found Electric Funeral and I remember going, ah, let me try this. In that moment that I taught myself how to play that riff and I started to play along with it, it was like the greatest feeling on earth, because I was like, I did it. I actually did this. And it was almost like, you know, making fire for the first time. It was like, I did it, you know? It was cool.
I was listening to Black Country Communion on the way down here.
Awesome.
It's the Electric Communion.
Yeah, of course. Another insane band.
Oh, that's absolutely right. Absolutely
right. Love them.
You, one of the earliest reviews I read of you from a guy that had heard you maybe on stage at a jam, he said, and I can just imagine this wizened old hack sat there going, this kid, he plays the blues like a 65-year-old from Mississippi.
Oh, man.
This is incredible. So, do you, I mean, when you see things like that,
yeah.
Because you were, I mean, this was 10, 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm,
so you're in your 20s.
Yeah.
I mean, you're walking around another, well, not that it's really possible to get another couple of inches taller than you, but it fills you with a bit more adrenaline.
Oh, yeah. When people started to take notice like that, like, I didn't really get into more, like, of course I love the classic rock, but when I found the blues, I was probably 16 years old, and I was like, it was like I uncovered this gem, and I was so excited about it. And until I was probably 22 years old, I didn't even really flirt with the rock stuff again. I was pure blues. And when people started to say stuff like that, it was like, I felt like it was important what I was doing to keep going on.
Yeah.
And to really spread the awareness, because there's a lot of great guitar players, there's a lot of incredible musicians, but the blues, we've said it a million times and it's true, it's the foundation. It is the red thread that goes through all genres. And to me, the blues is the most like respectful, eternal music there will ever be.
The left-handed thing.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, Kurt Cobain was always moaning that he could never find a guitar that suited him, that fitted you. You found quite early on, and then of course you're now known as Mr. Ambassador.
Yeah, for Gibson.
For Gibson, I mean, Joe Bonamassa knows you as always calls you the Ambassador.
Mr. Ambassador, yeah.
Who's Mr. Ambassador there? Did anybody try to coach the left-handedness out of you, or did you just settle on that and think, no, this is me, this is what I'm going
to
do?
That's what I settled on. And, you know, even being a kid, going back to being a kid and writing left-handed, I remember my teachers tried to make me switch, and it just made me more confused. So with the guitar, I just made a point. It was like, yes, I'm left-handed, like, I'm just going to take the road less traveled. And I think that ultimately, it was a cool thing because, yet again, and I also play with my fingers, so I never thought that those would be defining parts of my style, but it did turn out to be, which is kind of cool. And I think
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, exactly. Two words.
You've done 500 shows, 500 appearances by the time you're 21.
Oh yeah.
You said that I learned about the hard work ethic very early on in my life from humping bales of paper 11 hours.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. My first job was I worked at a farm, and the guy drove an old El Camino, a really old rotten El Camino, all rusty. We'd sit in the back and we'd drive about 10 miles to these farm fields. He'd get on the tractor, crack a beer, and he would have it so it'd be putting the hay bales with the ropes around them, and they'd fling back, and me and my friend had to be careful when they come back, and we'd have to grab them and we'd have to stack them, and we would stack hay bales for 11 hours a day, and he would pay us in change from his pocket at the end of the day. And I remember telling my parents, I was like, I think I should be getting more money. And my dad was like, nope, this is what you get, because he was like the old farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
And then my second job, I milked cows. So there's, I grew up in a completely different kind of vibe. So yeah, it was all old school. And when I found music, I did what I thought was normal. I said, okay, cool, I'm gonna play as many gigs as possible to as many people as possible, because not only was I was never thinking about like making money, I was thinking, because I wanna get better. I wanna and before I knew it, I was playing 4 to 5 nights a week for 3-4 years.
You've been written about in glowing terms, literally from the moment that you stepped on stage for the very first time in your life. And if you look at some of the firsts, I mean, you toured with a lot of the rock elite.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, the one moment that must stand out to you, and this is a bit like Richie Blackmore inviting somebody on stage to play Smoke on the Water, or Jimmy Page inviting somebody up to play rock and roll with Black Dog.
Yeah.
So you got Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah.
And you got Gary Rossington, and he's sitting there, and you've been playing support, and then one day he just says to you, look, you know, I want you on stage. And this has never ever been done before. He asks you to come on stage and jam during Sweet Home Alabama.
Yep.
Now, I mean, did you first of all think, fuck, this, I'm out of here.
Well, here's the thing. Like you said, I've been so lucky to get to play and meet and jam with so many of my heroes. But I remember we were playing in Germany, and it was like 14 or 15,000 person arena.
Yeah.
And we played, and I did my support, and he was watching the whole time. And then I'm walking off stage. He goes, "Hey, you're playing with us tonight. Sweet Home. It's an encore." It didn't even register in my head what he said. I was like, "All right, cool, man." Then his tech walks up to me and goes, "You need to be here in, 73 minutes. Tune your guitar down a half step. We're playing Sweet Home. We'll have an amp and everything." And I'm sitting there going, "What?" So I'm in the back, and I'm in like this arena, and I'm in like a locker room, put Sweet Home Alabama on the phone, and I'm making sure I don't screw it up, because we've all heard it a million times. But then all of a sudden it's like, wait, I'm playing it with the band. So I go up there, and I remember I plugged into this big Marshall, and I plug in and I hit a chord, and it was just like, this is rock and roll. And I look around, I'm like, what? So then we're playing, and Gary walks over by me and goes, "Take the solo." I'm like, "Me? Take the solo to Sweet Home Alabama?" So I go up there and I just give it. And I just remember that moment. It was like one of those things where like it was like a complete circle, because I remember being a kid like everybody and listening to those songs and hearing those records and being like, wow, this is incredible. And then to be in that moment, it was just like beyond my wildest dreams.
You've got a very simple mantra, haven't you, for your music creation, and it is the original.
Yeah.
The original. Not easy in a genre which has been around as long as this has. So how do you maintain a degree of originality?
I think that always honoring the past and always quoting and being present and aware of all of the incredible music that's come before me and wearing my heroes on my sleeve, that's a big part of what it is. But also I think there's an attitude of no egos. You have to stay humble. You have to remember that, like you said, this has been such a long-standing tradition of music, and all that I can do is try and bring my own spin, my own breath of fresh air on what I already love. And I think the way that I try and do that is I just try and get out of my own head, and I think to myself, what am I trying to say as an artist? Where would I want to take this? And most of the time, when I stop thinking and I just get into it and I play, it's like that's the zone.
Your mantra. But the other one, I suppose, could be, yeah, and I don't know whether this might be of help to you, what about taking everything that you've learned so far and amplifying it?
That's so true, too. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I'm going to steal that.
The new album we talked about first, you're on a headline tour. The new album.
Yeah.
When you took it along to Eddie Spear, the what was in your mind wasn't what came out at the end. How much of an input did he have into the molding of this, into the project you've got?
Great question. Yeah, he basically served as kind of like, I feel like I brought him a bunch of ingredients, and he basically made the cake. It was as if I told him I wanted to make a record that served as the live menu for my show,
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I want a record that feels explosive, powerful. It's very, very concise, but also, a lot of times I'd be in the studio and I'd be working with a producer and they'd say, oh, keyboards would sound great on here. Mm. And it's like, yeah, they would, but I really wanted to make a record that felt like the live show.
Yeah, yeah.
So Eddie, he came in, he said, okay, there's a few things we can do. We need to set up and play it like we're in a performance. So like, you guys set up in a room, I'm gonna mic everything up, and it's not like he just threw a few mics. He was like scientific about it. And then he basically said, we're going to have you sing over it, and I'm going to manipulate it using, we're going to put a speaker in this reverb room. We're going to have a space echo or a Leslie organ on your guitar part here. And basically, he was able to help me take this vision of like a three-piece power trio, just like the classics, and make it feel like a record.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I loved.
You've always said, actually, haven't you, that the difficulty has been creating an album, mm-hmm, and creating songs to go on it that mirror what you're all about as a live performer.
Absolutely. I used to have a really hard struggle between stage and studio because I would feel like I would have to put on a different hat. Mm. And what's funny is as I grew as an artist and a musician, I found quickly that it's actually more about amplifying what you see on stage and being more honest with yourself.
What does it mean for you to be able to write and perform your own music on stage?
Oh, it means everything. It means everything. It's a certain freedom that I've never experienced before. Mm. I feel like the luckiest guy on earth because I get to truly express myself and be creative, and people, whether they like it or not, they seem to take interest.
And lastly, where is or what is the blues in 2023? What does it mean?
I think it's as simple as it always has been. It's a feeling. It's an emotion. It's something that is translated, especially through music, that I don't have to say anything to you. I can tell you exactly how I'm feeling, whether I'm mad, happy, depressed, whatever. It's just getting that emotion across, and I think that's the best part. Genreless, the blues is everywhere. It's just taking what I feel and making you feel it.
And your favorite album, mm-hmm. It's because it was one of these unusual things when I saw it. Your favorite album, Patsy Cline's collection from 1961.
Yeah.
In between all of that blues, rock, hard rock, heavy metal, the lot, that still stood out. Does that still stand?
I listen to it almost every other day. Patsy Cline, Santo and Johnny.
Santo and Johnny.
Yeah, The Ventures.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that.
Night Diner.
Oh, yeah, come on.
Sleepwalk.
Yeah, Sleepwalk, Crying in the Chapel.
Mm.
All of it.
Thank you very much for
your
time.
Man.
Good luck, and we look forward to seeing you back here.
Cheers.
Very soon. Your mantra that I came across, live an organized and manageable day life so you can be extreme and creative in your work.
I think that was Edgar Varese who said that. Yeah. But I loved it when I heard that. Was it Varese or Stravinsky? It was one of those two composers. And I heard it by Zappa, you know, you need to, you know, if you're writing material and, you know, you want to keep things moving and you want to be creative, but then when it comes to performance, see, it was Philip who's playing now, you know. What attracted me to him was the raw, visceral, even spiritual kind of thing that he connects with. And I think that's why people connect with him, because of that. And so that's what's always interested me in music. And that's what I try and do. I try and switch off. And it happened a couple of times tonight where thought stops. And it's not like you're playing, and that's what I'm trying to. That's always what I'm trying to get to, is that point. You know, sometimes it's hard because you know you're thinking, you're in your head. That's what I, you know. I'm quite selfish in the way that I kind of play for myself to feel that.
It's a big couple of months coming up because you've got the new album.
Yeah.
Invocation. Now, this is a really interesting title because the word means. It's like a calling to a higher power for some sort of message or assistance. So what's the story here behind invocation?
Because I think I do that before I go on stage. You know, I kind of, you know, whether it be, what, you know, that's sort of like maybe a bit, you know, sort of like too sort of close to the bone. but I do that because I want that, kind of feeling, that kind of vibe of it not being me.
Yeah.
I want to get myself completely out of the way of my playing and be connected to whatever it is that comes faster than the speed of thought. Because when you're playing, like for tonight, I haven't rehearsed. I know the songs, I know the lyrics, I know the structure, but the rest of it I don't. So I'm in front of a large audience like tonight. It's quite a sold out audience. Not knowing what I'm doing and trusting that it will happen. And that's kind of a very funny place because, you know, when I'm driving down here, I'm thinking, you know, geez, you know, half of me's thinking, but then it's the trusting yourself that it's there, and when it comes time to do it, that you won't fail, you know.
Because you can overthink.
You can overthink.
You can worry, stress, and then that's where the errors come.
You just gotta trust that you know you've put all the years in and it's there and all those things. And what's good about playing solo, which I sometimes forget and have to kind of remind myself, is that you can go anywhere. You can take it. You know, take the dynamic down. You can bring it up. You can make it atmospheric. You can make it raw and heavy. You've got complete control in the moment of doing any of those things, and it's trusting that you know that your instincts will tell you which way to go.
last album you recorded in pretty much a month. I mean, it was done start to finish very quickly.
Yeah.
This time, I mean, you've said that, you know, we've upped the game on every aspect. You've given yourself more creative freedom to explore things. So were you being sort of held back before this?
No, I think we just hit the groove on the Wings of Salvation, and that process was scarily fast and very odd in that kind of way. That normally, when I've written stuff in the past, I've kind of structured it myself on the computer when I'm working in my little studio, where I've got phone ideas and I've got fragments of things. With Wings of Salvation, it was a clean slate. I didn't go back and look for ideas. It was just like, okay, we're starting here. And I worked with Dave Marks, the producer, and between us, it was just unbelievably fast. So when I went to do this new album, I thought, well, I think I'll work with Dave again, because that team of people, Joe Webb mixing, him producing, and Paul Stewart playing drums, it just seemed like a combination that worked. And but I think the flow of the songs, the ideas in it, because when I write songs, I do it in the same way that I improvise guitar. Yeah. So I'll have a guitar with me. I'll just start playing and start improvising melodies, vocal melodies, and whatever comes through, you know, you can feel when it's right, and they generally come through quite quickly. And I think that happened, and just so the songs that came through just felt right immediately. And again, that was probably only 6 weeks with this new one. We took a little bit more time, and that was only because Dave had a schedule and he had other things in it that conflicted slightly with timeline, but it would have been, again, a quick album, you know, and it's great, you know. It's trying to capture essences of songs and get them recorded as quickly as possible without too much overproduction or overthinking, like you said, you know, because you can do the same in the song world, you know, you can do that, and then you record it, and then you sit back from it, and it took me a good month to go back to it. I left it alone and went back and listened, and I could listen like someone who wasn't involved with the process again. And I was, you know, I was pretty pleased that these things are sort of were so different and yet not contrived. You're almost like, where did that come from? You know, where did that idea come? And that's great. You know, that's what I'm all about, that kind of thing. And that's where Invocation, I think, come, you know, as well, ties into that. You know, that whole, you know,
so can we expect surprises? Can we expect something that is different from that has gone before?
Yeah.
I know you played a couple of tracks out there tonight, which sounded quite markedly different.
Well, Get Away, the new single, is kind of more straightforward rock and roll. You know, it's kind of, it's got hat tips to things that I was interested in when I was 13, 14, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's got that, because I love that. I've got a soft spot for that sort of. So there are those influences in there. The Natives that I played tonight has more of a tribal kind of vibe going on. So it's, you know, definitely on the recording, it's more vibey. There's a song on there called Blind Me that's very much sort of almost country, you know, which I'm not a country fan, but it's kind of, it's very
in vogue at the moment, isn't it? Sort of like Americana, roots rock.
Yeah. But, you know, that one just, again, it just came out on the chord progression and the vocal, and I sort of ran with that. But it's not sickly country, you know, it's more, I don't know, you know, but it's got tinges of that. But it, you know, there are different elements, you know, one of the next records I want to make is a complete departure from, you know, the song structure. You know,
it's not a Christmas album, is it?
No. But this may be down the road. You know, it may be a side project. But I've got a very keen interest in, you know, things like Zappa, that kind of whole world of music. And I've released an album called Thunder Moon on Bandcamp quietly during lockdown. And it's all instrumental, and there's definitely ideas there that are completely left field from anything I've done, and I'd love to, you know, explore that.
Because your influences, I mean, I know when people ask this favourite question, you know, it's the same names, isn't it? Trotted out, yeah, well, you know, Hendrix changed my life and whatever. But there's classical in yours, Stravinsky, Debussy, two composers I've seen you mention before.
Yeah.
So there's more influencing you than just what we would expect.
100%, yeah. You know, what I listen to for pleasure in the car would not be expected. Obviously, I love blues and I love blues rock, but that's just one piece of a puzzle, and I wouldn't want to stay there. You know, it's like eating the same meal every day. You know, I wouldn't want to do that. You know, and I think the beauty and the complexity of some classical composers that interests me. And again, we go back to Zappa. Rhythmic complexity has always fascinated me, and that guy is just the master of. But like he took from Stravinsky and a lot of those guys, and Edgar Varèse. And that's probably why I went down that route, really. But I've always been fascinated with that. You know, time signatures on the last album, I delve into that. But on Thunder Moon, there's lots of time signature music, because I just...
So could you take that now and not quietly release it? Release it into a noisy environment?
It depends what you're... It's a tricky thing, because if you want people to... listen to your music or know who you are, and I've been around a while, but I'm still kind of on the fringes. You have to have music that is going to get played, that's kind of like within a framework to be accepted.
Absolutely, yeah.
I could easily sort of go down the route of making avant-garde sort of strange music, but who would hear it? Who would listen? But there again, it's that kind of thing. Should that be the... I'm asking myself, it's just like rhetorical, but should you make music for a consumer, or should it be just art,
Well, if you were in the 60s and early, then it would definitely be, you do it for the art. I mean, there has to be an economic into it, otherwise there would be no musicians and there would be no music.
End of story.
But the other thing that interests me about you is you have a hand in the whole package. You nearly went to art school. It was your parents that didn't want you to go to art school, wasn't it?
It was unfortunate. I left school at a time when not many people went to university in the sort of 80s. It was kind of like, just a handful of people or college. And I got three older brothers who were kind of 10 years older than me. And they'd left home and got jobs and worked. So when it came my turn to finish school, I wanted to go to art college, and at the time it was like the big goth thing. So you'd see people in the local city with the big hair.
Yeah,
so my parents associated art college with goths and drugs. So it was a no.
The talent is unbelievable, because I don't know how many people know who are watching this that you actually design and you do the whole thing with the album covers, which are almost like individual works of art. And not only that, it's the merchandise as well that you're designing, because you have a clothing company, don't you?
Yes.
So you're doing the whole thing.
It's interesting, because I did a short stint as an apprentice, as a tattooist apprentice, back in around 2000, and so I've always carried on sort of drawing a bit, but not much. But as I've got older, without practicing, things have become easier, and I don't know why that is. Whether my eyes got better over time, just with age, I don't know. So I'm as surprised as when I'm doing this stuff that I can do it. And I'm pleased. It's something that, because it's a part of me that didn't get a chance to kind of get developed, that I can incorporate it into what I'm doing now.
And the merchandise is a big thing, because I know that you take care about the way the items are produced and the quality of the items, and you're using organic cotton. You want it's not like those nights where we used to come out of the big venues, buy the t-shirt off the guy for a tenner because you didn't want to pay 50 quid for one, and then it shrunk within a week. But you're all about creating good quality, not only music, album covers, art, and the merchandise as well.
It rests on my shoulders. I'm not signed. It's a cottage industry, and I want it to be as good as it possibly can, because it's happening now. There's not time to kind of develop that or get that better in the future. It needs to be the time that it's kind of working.
I'm sitting there, I'm listening to you, and I look at your album covers and look at the merchandise and watch you play live, and you're thinking, well, what else do you need to do in order to be signed?
Well, a label approached me probably 4 months ago from the States, but they wanted to package up a kind of like an introduction to album, taking tracks from my other work, you know, and putting it together as an album. And I just finished this album. I just put money into it myself. So I spent thousands making the new album, which was hard to get that money together. So, you know, it was a labor of love, and it was expensive, and it was just on me. So when someone wanted to take that and put it, you know, just take a couple of tracks from that, and I was like, well, you know, I need to put this out as a piece of a piece of work. So maybe I will go, you know, but it's difficult with, you know, with signing, you know, because doing it by yourself, you do recoup and you do make money eventually, but it's hard. If you go with the label, they're putting money up front, so that money has to be recouped before you get anything. It's hard. So, you know, I think these days, but the one thing about, you know, being doing it yourself, you know, you have some degree of control of what you want to put out, maybe. I don't know. I don't think there's any... There's pros and cons both ways, you know. I think maybe you'll get more visibility with the label, that they can maybe help with that. But it's not like the old days, it's not like the 80s where you suddenly get a huge advance.
A million quid.
Yeah. So that's not going to happen. So, you know, and they certainly wouldn't be interested in the album that I'd like to create, you know, and I will make that album. If someone said to me, you've got 2 years left to live, you know, what do you want to leave, what body of work do you want to leave behind? I know the album I want to make.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've not made it, but, you know, it's kind of, you know, germinating. So I need to do that, and I need to do it fairly soon, you know.
And listen, you are the only, the only person I think I know, actually, certainly in this country, that has their own line of hats.
Right.
Vera Black create, or you work with Vera Black to design, design things. You have the Troy Redfern Gambler.
I do. I'm not wearing it at the moment, but yeah, I do have that. She's great. You know, Vera makes amazing products, you know, and she's a lovely person, and Luke, her husband. If you're looking for really good quality,
she has got a fabulous website.
She has. Yeah. She's great, you know, and they do really well. They do a lot of the festivals, the, you know, sort of all the major festivals they're at. So it's great how they've done that, you know.
Brilliant. So new album is coming early part of next year. When are you back out on the road again? Because I don't imagine it will be long.
We've got a tour that's been locked in for middle of next year. So that'll be
UK based
tour. It's co-headline. I can't announce who the other person is yet because the tour has been announced.
Right.
But that'll be a good one, and it's probably.
So you're Jared
30,
again.
12:30. Say again.
Is that... You're Jared.
Yeah.
or of course, when rivers meet.
Not with those guys again. No, this is a co-headline. So what we'll do is we'll kind of swap each night who goes on last. But it'll be, you know, it's going to be a good one. And can't wait to get out there again and do a full set with the band.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you very much.
No, thank
Great
you.
Show tonight.
Thank
and
you.
Looking forward to the album Invocation, which is out in February. Troy Redfern, everybody, if you haven't got a ticket, there are still a couple left for this run of this tour, and it's well worth the time.